Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Today we're obviously an OIG
wine
coffee table.
Coffee table, there it is.
We're the OIG coffee table versus the round table, which means that the Knights of the Round Table aren't existing today. Our partner in crime, Wade, on a mission today. He's at a client meeting and will not be here, which is the functional equivalent of him taking unapproved PTO from the round table. We'll address that later.
Searching for the Holy Grail.
That's correct. But of course, I've got Matt Kachansky, retired SAC, special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and my counterpart on as senior director of the payment integrity team here at Advise. So we want to talk today, interestingly, you know, last week we talked about the increase in ABA cases and ABA therapy and the fraud, waste, abuse issues that go on with that and some of the ways that we could deal with that. And then interestingly enough, OIG must have watched the OIG roundtable and they posted a study that was done involving the state of Colorado for what appears to be a work plan review that was done for 2022 and 2023 that was just released last week. Some of the highlights they identified: between 2019 and 2023, state of Colorado had an increase in their Medicaid spending for ABA therapy from $60 million to $163 million. And so obviously there was a very large uptick in essentially a four-year period. Now, obviously, some of the issues involving ABA, and I believe there are only four different codes that encompass ABA. But obviously, one of the things that comes up when we have these discussions is, why is there this tectonic increase in the cost for ABA therapy? Why has everybody been more in tune to ABA therapy? Why has it become the flavor du jour? And there's a lot of reasons for that, and these are all speculative in nature, but part of it is that obviously as medicine grows and as modalities grow, the ability to diagnose and the ability to put people into proper therapies and treatment regimens increases, and so that could be part of the reason. But also, because there is a lot of money that is paid in the Medicaid space for this, because it is predominantly in the Medicaid space, we see a lot of these therapy sessions coming up, that there's obviously going to be a tectonic cost that's going to be involved in that. So there are a lot of reasons why we're seeing upticks in ABA therapy. The least of which is that for some of these ABA therapy instances, you can have these services rendered in your home for 5 days a week. And so there's a huge convenience factor, particularly if you are the parent of a child who suffers from autism or a related service, a related diagnosis that needs ABA therapy services. You may be in a place where packaging up your child and bringing them to a center to get the therapy just may be a challenge. And so sometimes these kinds of therapies may work best in the home setting, where if you have a child needing these therapies, they can get the best care in the most comfortable of locations, right? Where they're able to get these therapies and feel like they're in a safe space that they may need to be in. So there's a lot of reasons why, but obviously with that comes a whole host of issues involving fraud, waste, and abuse. In this study, they did a sample of 100. So obviously, Matt, when we see 100, first thing that comes to mind is it is a statistically valid random sample using RAT stats. So we say that's the first point. And so we look at that and we say, okay, where's it coming from there? This study was interesting. It looked at the 100 record sample. They found 93 instances in which there were documentation related issues and 17 instances in which the individuals purportedly rendering these services were not properly credentialed. So Matt, missing documentation, inaccurate documentation, inappropriate documentation. You know, one of the things that we know from doing these reviews as part of our SIU is there's always the interest and desire to incorporate technology and AI and all of these other catchphrases that are out there relative to doing these reviews. But at the end of the day, there's still a very strong need to have the human intelligence piece, right? So the data is going to get us to show, hey, Colorado went from $60 million to $163 million. Now, I didn't look to see if the work plan was specific to Colorado or because of that reason, because of that large dollar amount, or if Colorado was already on the radar or whatever the story is, but that's inconsequential. But it all starts with the fact that they picked a sample of 100 records, and it was, you know, then you have your review and all of that. And so while AI and technology and data analytics are all great pieces of the puzzle, you still need that human piece, because at the end of the day, the human piece is what ultimately determined that the medical records did not support the code's build. And so you had a 93% error rate on that, and you had a 17% error rate on the lack of the proper staff. And it is likely that, you know, even if AI were to come up with the ability to mine the records for proper documentation, you're going to still need that human element for at least that portion of the puzzle with proper staffing. Now, we did a little bit of homework and identified that in the state of Colorado, in order for you to render the services for Medicaid, you must be credentialed through the behavior analysis analysts kind of national credentialing group. And so it really is a matter of looking at the records and then going out onto that organization and doing some research. So you really do need that human element from the investigative perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, the AI models can get you so far. Like with ABA therapy, one of the requirements of documentation is to have the patient's name and date of birth on every page of the documentation. AI could probably find that and you know, point out the pages that are missing. But in terms of whether the treatment plan is there, if the treatment plan is showing progress throughout, if the supervisory codes are showing that they've gone in there, they've done an analysis, they've come up with a new treatment plan based on things in the past, I don't think you're going to find that through AI, at least not the AI of today. I mean, that's, you still need the human element. You need specialized with ABA, specialized human experience in this type of therapy. It is unique in what they do. This therapy, this, we can talk about policies in a minute. 5 days a week can be up to however many hours a day. It could be 12 hours a day. This therapy is teaching these kids how to live in society. They're training behavior, you know, minute by minute. You know, how do they react to things? Do they have outbursts? How do they solve those outbursts? Those types of things take hours at a time. And what some of the data shows, you know, is perhaps those hours aren't spent in therapy. You know, bathroom breaks, meals, naps. These kids can be 2 years old. You know, are they going through 12 hours of therapy in a day? Not sure. But it's going to take a human being reviewer to look at that. And we've seen some trends in policies now across the states where they're putting limits on the number of hours of therapy, either overall or in a month and a week, and putting caps on those things, where before, like everything else, the therapy came before the policies. So the policies now are catching up to these things. You see the big differences. Nebraska, I talked about before, has put into place these types of policies now that are limiting the number of hours. They've lowered the hourly rate for this for these codes. Whereas New York, on the commercial side, there's no such policy. That credentialing policy in Colorado does not exist in New York for commercial patients.
Well, and you know, the interesting thing, Matt, you talk about is the fact that the policies don't keep up with the, we'll call it the technology or the therapies, whatever. But, you know, we see that in a lot of spaces, even outside of healthcare, right? We see it right now with AI and all of this other stuff. Technology is always moving at a rate faster than the regulatory organizations can keep up with. And that becomes the challenge, particularly in our space. You know I always go back in default to the discussions about COVID, but you know, that really gives you the most relevant kind of time stamping to things, you know, in our space, is that the policies and the regulations are ever evolving and ever changing. And so it really becomes an important piece of the investigative puzzle that when you are finding something that doesn't seem to fit the square peg and the square hole, that trying to punch the square peg and the round hole is not going to work. Because in the regulatory landscape, you know, at the end of the day, if someone goes and tries to fight a denial, the payer has to rely on some empirically derived set of rules and some factually based thing, right? It's not innuendo. It's not assumptions. It's based upon.
It's not what feels right or seems normal. It's
right.
What is codified.
Right, right. It's not right. We're not having hunches. I felt like this was not the right thing to build for. So, so, you know, when you look at the Colorado analysis where 93% error rate, that to me was mind boggling that it was that high. And so even if you have an instance in which the services were actually rendered, and there's not even an argument that the services weren't rendered. By the way, at the end of this, Colorado disagreed with one of the findings. They agreed with three of the, there were five findings. One they disagreed with, three they agreed with in part, and one they had a partial agreement with. So, you know, what that tells me is that OIG was in the right space, right? It wasn't like there were five findings and Colorado disagreed with all five. They agreed with 60%. And then another, say 10%, right? So 70% was agreed to. And that to me says a lot about the fact that either the providers have a level of confusion, because at the end of the day, while this audit is a reflection, and we say this all the time, when OIG does a study off of the work plan, it is ultimately a reflection of how the entity that's being audited, the parent of that entity, or you know, the global part of the entity, is enforcing, right? So when CMS does an audit, or when OIG does an audit of a hospital for something, and they find all of these overpayments, it's really a reflection of how CMS is enforcing its policies. The hospital that's audited is the cannon fodder. They're just the shrapnel for that. In this instance, it's the same thing. The state of Colorado didn't appropriately enforce certain rules and regulations, but it ultimately becomes an issue for whoever, you know, whoever the provider was that they did the audit on. The problem becomes when you have a case in which it's a poor documentation case that would have led to a claim being denied, it's always going to be in a retrospective review when we get to the discussion that we have pretty frequently about clean claims. CMS has a clean claims rule. I haven't looked to see if Colorado has one, but most states have a clean claims rule, which basically means as long as all of the fields are properly completed that are the mandatory fields on the CMS 1500 form or the 837 file, as long as those things are accurate in the sense that they are not mismatched and you don't get a denial, you're playing pay and chase because you don't have the ability to look at those records, right? So that human element still comes into play. So while I think there's a, you know, the fact that there's a 93% error rate, it doesn't take away the fact that how do you stop an error rate of 93% for missing or lack of documentation to support the code when you're not seeing that documentation in real time? It's always going to be retrospective unless you put every payer on prepay and you do a stop and verify approach, which is impossible to do.
Correct. And with ABA especially, the documentation is very complex, and the requirements of those four codes is very complex as to what has to be documented. Looking at their SVRS, you know, did they look at like one day at random per patient? Did they do a group of days in a row for patient? All of that probably matters a lot to the study because some of these codes are, you've got a treatment plan. Are the treatments then the therapy sessions showing progress against that treatment plan, to where then the supervising therapist comes in, sees the progress or the lack of progress, and makes changes to the regimen. If you're just getting one day out of that 15 days or whatever it might be that month, that's not going to show that. So how do you do a thorough review? So the plans, if you're going to do these types of cases, you might want to do your framing by patient and range of dates rather than just individual dates of service to get a better view of what that therapy is what therapy is going on and whether it's in line with the progress of the treatment plan and all that.
Right. You know, that's a great point. I know we talk about this a lot when we're talking about ancillary services, or we're talking about services that are continuing and ongoing, right? So let's talk about in the therapy space, right? Physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, ABA therapy, things of that sort. These are going to be things that are derived off of the individual services are derived from a plan of care that starts the process going in a lot of these. And so it is important that from the SIU perspective, if you are doing one of these cases, it is very important that you are looking at a range of dates for the member, specifically so that you can capture all of the things. If you capture a particular patient on a particular date of service, you're only getting a vacuum. That's not really a fulsome and complete audit. It's a snapshot. It's similar to when we have discussions with our payer clients that we're doing advisory work for, where they may be looking at a facility for example, an MRI, an ancillary service in the lab space, diagnostic testing, something like that. You've got to get the underlying document from the provider that led to that. The fact that a patient had an ultrasound or a blood test or something, the documentation that you're going to get from the provider of that service is going to confirm that you know, so-and-so had a transcranial Doppler. But is it telling you what were the things that led up to the diagnosis of transcranial Doppler? You might have to go and get collateral documents, you know, the E&Ms, right? So you have to think a little bit. It can't just be mechanical. When we're talking about these therapies, that's a great example. And when you're doing these, when you're framing out your statistically valid random samples or even your probe samples, in these instances, your sampling methodology should include a patient and not just individual dates of service. Now, the problem you run into is, you know, if I'm talking about a statistically valid random sample and I'm using patients, I've got 100 patients, but that could wind up being 500 pages of records. There could be, if you do a 12-month period and you've got someone getting ABA therapy 5 days a week, you're talking about, you know, a lot of dates of service, right? If they're getting Monday through Friday, you know, do the math, 5 days a week times 52 weeks a year, and you could be looking at a substantial amount. But, you know, when we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars going out in these items, services, and procedures, you've got to account for that. And so that's why your initial salvo may not be a statistically valid random sample. Maybe it is a probe sample of 30. And again, we always tout 30. The PIM, Program Integrity Manual, Chapter 8, Statistical Sampling, Overpayment Estimation, and Probe Sampling, CMS has identified a probe sample of 20 to 40. We say 30. Let's be consistent unless you have a reason to do something other than that. So it is important to do that. So Matt, for the last piece of this, you know, to me, part of this is the right person, the right project, you know, and I think that sometimes what winds up happening is investigators, because they've never worked on a particular type of case, they shy away from it. They get nervous. And, you know, the thing is that curiosity is good and you should be willing to look at things, learn and develop your crafts. And I know you say it all the time that every case you work on makes you a subject matter expert on the case that you're working on. So part of it is right person, right project. And by that, I mean, if I was to get an ABA case and I've never done one before, I need to, you know, you've got to give it to the person that's curious to learn about it, but also where are the right people to facilitate you being that expert? You know, do you have auditors on your team who have done these cases before? Do you have investigators on your team who have done these cases before? So that is one of the things that helps to create not only efficiency, but also works towards that collaborative environment.
Right. Internally, we have a cadre of CPCs that they are the ones who get all of the ABA cases because it is such a specialized field. We've got specialists that do those cases for us. They do other cases as well, but they're the only ones that do the ABA cases. And in terms of specialization and being able to go to someone, absolutely important. We've created like a matrix of specialties and knowledge bases for all of our employees. So, and we give that out to the staff. So if they get something assigned, they'll know that they can go to Bob and learn about home health or assisted living facilities, things like that. If they get an ABA case, they can go to Mary, and she's the expert on that. She's had 4 or 5 successful cases with that. We provide that information to our staff so that they know that they've got people they can go to and not just be treading water trying to figure this out for themselves. We also have a reference library of all the policies and things like for each plan and according to specialty or claim type or and things like that. So we have those references, we have those resources available. It's, and you can't do it without that.
Yeah, and that's super, and that's super important. And that's, you know, for us, our team is comprised of people who are we'll call them multidisciplinary. But you know, as I say all the time, if you have ever looked through the code book, the CPT book or the HCPCS book, you know, they're this big, and it is impossible to be omnipotent to every code that's out there. And but if you have multidisciplinary experience, you are someone who clearly has the ability to pivot and understand and do some of these things. You know, we have some people on our team who are unidimensional, meaning, you know, they just do a certain type of audit or a certain type of review that's out there. And so, you know, those are people that have very niche skills, and those are needed. You need that mix to be able to do that. And you've got to be able to know where you're sending that work to be able to be able to have that. So this to me was, it was an interesting review, only because ABA is becoming at the forefront. We've been talking about it. But, you know, when I saw the fact that 17% error rate for people that weren't properly credentialed, you know, that to me is the easiest of the things to try to identify. But then you start to get into some of the nuances that are out there vis-a-vis the lack of documentation and things of that sort. The 93% to me was shocking, to say the least, because I just think that you're seeing an error rate that high. You have to question, you know, is the 17% of unqualified people, they're creating the 93% error rate because they don't know how to create the documentation? Are they separate? You know, I don't know. We'd have to look a little bit deeper into that.
Probably some of that, an education issue, because there is a lot that has to be put into that documentation.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. So for anybody who's out there and is in this, just, you know, take a quick Google OIG work plan, Colorado study. You'll find it. It'll come up very quickly. So interesting topic. I think, you know, we'll see a lot more of this. The ABA stuff is really becoming at the forefront, particularly since it is really hitting into the Medicaid, and we're starting to see those limits in some states as to what and how much they're going to pay, so that it is not an open door. I'd love to see in the Medicaid space, I'd love to see there be policies that do some similar things for home visits and things of that sort. I mean, obviously, when you're going to pay your grandchild or your daughter, son, whatever, there's an inherent issue there. And I think, you know, when we start talking about things like EVV and all of that, and tightening up the ability to have a better handle on those policies. So it's, you know, it's an ongoing, there's some ongoing issues with Medicaid that, you know, I think will be addressed in the coming years as OIG continues to do these analyses and these studies. So Wade, we missed you, but Matt, you did a great job talking on behalf of everything. So that was good. You did a
step, you know, in the breach.
Good job. Yeah, good job. So again, everybody, we thank everybody for tuning in every week to the roundtable, this week's coffee table. Again, sign up for our newsletter every week. It comes right to your inbox, where you can get a copy of the OIG roundtable. If anybody has not looked at Jean Marie's kind of fun video blog she does, the Long Island Library. There are two R's in library. It's not a library, it's a library. No R's have been hurt. And again, I'm always here to translate any of that if needed. And so sign up for our newsletter, catch our weekly podcast, catch our LinkedIn Lives, catch it on Spotify or our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, look up Advice Health, hit that button that says subscribe, and you'll get all of our weekly podcasts. So thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you, everybody.